This is Jamal Derbelli. You are listening to WGXC 90.7 FM, operating Acra, Catskill, and Hudson.
Though WGXC has been around for almost 3 years, we still hear people asking,
WGXC, what is
where
it?
Are they located? WGXC, what is
a
it? Where is
radio
it? Where are they located?
In Columbia County?
What do they play?
What kind of music do they play?
Is that
the one with the guy in the morning? County?
Where are they located?
What do they play? How do I get information?
That's where you come in. As a member of WGXC's Outreach Committee, you'll be able to answer these questions. Tell people who we are, where we are, what we do, how we do it. Meetings are scheduled on the first Thursday of every month at either our Hudson or Catskill studio. To learn more, contact Jess at jess@wgxc.org.
WGXC underwriting support is provided by the Catskill Community Center, providing after-school and summer programs in arts, athletics, education, and recreation to the youth of our community. Also providing art classes, community yoga, parenting classes, and Zumba to adults. 344 Main Street in Catskill, and online at catskillcommunitycenter.org.
The views expressed by volunteer on-air hosts do not represent or reflect the views of WGXC. WGXC is nonpartisan and does not endorse or support political candidates. To participate in WGXC's on-air dialogue, call 518-828-0290 or email info@wgxc.org.
Good morning. This is At Issue with Deborah Gilbert. Victor Mendolia will not be here today, but he'll be back in 2 weeks. And I'm here with Hudson Common Council President Don Moore.
Good to be with you.
Good morning, Don.
Good
Welcome.
Morning. Thank you.
And we had a meeting last night in Hudson, and we're here to discuss the mass gathering. Would you call that a law?
Yes, it is. It is. Mass gathering is a law. Yes, it's a section of the Hudson City Code.
And could you give us a little background first? How long has this been before the council? I understand the mayor vetoed it before. When did that happen? And what's the story on that? Why would he veto it?
Well, that's a number of questions. Let me try to put them in a little order. Hudson has had a mass gathering provision in its code for I don't know how many years. Frankly, it's probably something on the order of 25. What the council did was to amend the law, which is to say, certain provisions within the existing law were amended. This amendment process started almost a year ago, possibly more than a year ago, in the legal committee. We've been working on it back and forth since then. We've been looking at a number of situations having to do with mass gathering. One of them is that Hudson, because it is growing and becoming, it's becoming much more dynamic, and many more people want to have events at the waterfront, have events in other parks and public venues in the city, want to have more parades, want to use the particularly our main street, Warren Street, for events, parades, static events that take place in one block on Warren Street or on one block on other streets within the city. State Street, Union Street come to mind as well, where there have been events. So we looked at what changes might be valuable. And indeed, we did have one situation where there was a fairly slight event that occurred on Warren Street that had the street closed for about 8 hours. And that did get us thinking, and I won't quarrel with the mayor on the fact that that was one of the issues that brought the possibility of examining the existing mass gathering permit law into our attention. However, that's how any law changes. Something occurs, and you discover that it might be valuable, you know, to examine a law and see whether or not it needs to be updated or improved. And that's what we did. What we did was to extend the application deadline for a mass gathering permit from 60 to 120 days. which means that within that a mass gathering permit should be submitted 120 days before the event takes place. Now, why did we do that? For one reason, we did it because larger events really do require a great deal more involvement, both by principally by the promoters and the producers of the event, Flag Day, Pride Day, Winter Walk. Almost all the events that we have take at least a good year's lead time to put together, but not all of them do. And some of them, some of these events are much smaller, and they don't require the same examination by the mayor or the police department or DPW in terms of what services they may or may not need. And so there has been in the law, and is retained in the law, the opportunity for the mayor at his or her discretion to waive that particular requirement. So in other words, if somebody has an event, they have a wedding, they have a birthday party, and there are going to be more than 50 people who are going to attend, and they're going to use either a public street or a public space, they could come in, you know, under that 120-day limit, as they have already come in under the 60-day limit, to apply for and gain a mass gathering permit. The next provision that we made was for what's called notice. With large events that entail closing a public street, what we wanted to do was find a way to be sure that the neighborhoods that were involved were around those events were somehow notified and had a chance to comment to the mayor on their view of a particular of an event that was proposed. We looked at a number of strategies, sending postcards to an affected area, but none of them were really worked because they seemed too burdensome on whoever was going to produce the event. And then the publisher of the Register Star came forward and proposed that the paper would publish at a discounted rate, a deeply discounted rate, a notice of an event. And that was clearly the right answer, which is to say that you use the public papers to make an announcement, give notice of an upcoming event. So that cured that. We also then made sure that we had a separate calendar on the Hudson City website, and this is something that I think we already have in place. We have a calendar that there's already a calendar on the Hudson City website that provides information on city meetings and events. But there is now a second calendar that you can find a link to at the bottom of the main calendar that takes you to a listing of all of the mass gathering events, either those that have been approved and those that have for which applications have been submitted. So they're all there.
So you're making it as easy as possible for an event organizer.
We have tried to make it easy for an event organizer who's organizing specifically an event that closes a street to give notice, so that if there are any reservations or comments that the public wants to make, they will have notice. They will know in advance that an event is planned, and they can comment to the mayor. But it's also with the acknowledgments on the website. One of the other facts of life is if you're trying to plan events, you want to know whether or not there's another big event that's happening at the same time. This event planners, are up against this all the time. And so we've both the notice in the Register Star and the notice on the calendar on the Hudson City website give people an opportunity to look and see, well, hey, I can't use the waterfront or 7th Street Park because it's already taken on the day or the hour that I want to do something. Or you simply know that, if you're planning a big event, you don't want to have it up against another big event. So I think that's, yes, I do believe it really will make it easier for people to both plan and stage events.
Given the fact that the mayor has had this discretionary power and will continue to have it, how do you explain the quote that he gave to the Register Star that is in the article about last night's meeting, where he says, "I would like all organizers planning events in the future to please become familiar with these new changes, because it could prevent you from having your event if you do not understand some of the added language changes to the mass gathering law."
Well, that's a little too vague for me to interpret. An answer to your question and to a question that was posed last night at the council meeting, will this prevent events from happening where they are, where an application would be made within 120 days? Again, my answer is no. The mayor has had the discretion in the existing law, retains the discretion within the new provisions to waive the deadline requirement. And as I said, there's a little provision, a concept within the Hudson City Charter, and that is that any time a law is passed that reduces the power of any official, particularly the mayor, that law cannot be adopted without a referendum, which means that when you're crafting legislation, as we did, you need to be careful to make sure that you don't run afoul of this provision. So we were very careful of the provision, this concept that says you cannot diminish the powers of the mayor without having a law go before the public for a referendum. So we made very clear that the discretionary authority that existed in the current law was maintained in the new provision. And that particular point has been misunderstood. I think it will become clearer as the discussion goes forward, because there are just many, many examples of when that has happened in recent years, just this year and last year.
How often has the mayor used his discretionary powers in respect to events that have been taking place in Hudson?
Well, I don't actually have a count of it because I didn't think, frankly, it was going to be necessary. But I do know that with applications, with the submission of materials that need to be provided, insurance materials, that, for example, that indeed those deadlines have been set aside, have been waived. And as I say, there really isn't any reason for the public, who wish to produce any sort of event, large or small, to believe that a 120-day standard is somehow rigid, hard, and fast. That simply isn't the case. I know that that was a concern that was raised. Actually, I don't believe that concern was raised. Well, it might have been in the veto message. It might have been in the veto message, yes. But as I say, it's something that it's difficult for those of us who have been carefully putting this law together to understand why that concern would be voiced, because we simply don't. The common council, insofar as it has overridden the mayor's veto on this issue, has stated by so doing that we don't think we do believe that the mayor retains the discretion on these mass gathering permits.
Now, let's name a couple of great events that happen in Hudson so that people know exactly what we're talking about. I'm thinking of Winter Walk.
Sure.
That's got to be one of the older, wonderful events.
Right. Winter Walk, the Flag Day, Pride Day, Black Arts Festival, the Hudson Music Festival, the Hudson River Exchange, the craft fair that's happened for the last two summers. These are fairly substantial events. And of course, the fire department had its regional inspection parade this past weekend, and they had an event at the waterfront. Now, three of the events that we've mentioned, the Pride Day, the Hudson River Exchange, and the fire department, all not only requested mass gathering permits, but they also desired to and planned to sell alcohol. And insofar as they did that, they required not a $1 million liability insurance policy, but a $3 million insurance policy. The Hudson City Code, again, in the mass gathering provision that existed this heretofore, and which continues to exist, requires a $1 million liability insurance policy for any mass gathering event. Now, the mayor can waive that, but rarely does.
Even if it's just blocking off one block of a public street.
Absolutely. You know,
taking up a little bit of a park.
Right. You do have to have the liability insurance. But again, a liability insurance for $1 million can cost $100. It's not expensive. There have been questions raised about the $3 million alcohol policy insurance coverage. And I've pointed out, and I can point out here, that provision has existed in the Hudson City Code since 2006. In other words, for the past 8 years, if you wish to plan an event and use the Hudson City waterfront and serve alcohol, you had to have a maximum of $3 million liability insurance. And that covered not only just alcohol, but general liability. It wasn't $1 million plus $3 million. It was simply $3 million rather than $1 million. Just this year, for example, the Hudson Pride Foundation had a three-day event. They had a parade, and they had an event at the waterfront, and then they had cruises, I think, Friday and Saturday, or Saturday and Sunday, a three-day event with alcohol served. They obtained a $3 million liability policy, which I have personally inspected because I wanted to be able to tell people that it was real, and they paid $675 for $3 million worth of coverage for those 3 days. The Hudson River Exchange, the craft fair, had served alcohol, beer and wine, I'll explain that in a second, on 2 days. They paid $275 for their $3 million worth of insurance. I don't know what the fire department paid because I haven't talked to them about that. But I know that they got the insurance, and it can't have cost, you know, and it has to have been in that neighborhood, probably the lower of the two numbers that I just quoted. Now, as to alcohol, again, since 2006, there has been a specific section in the Hudson City Code, not within the mass gathering law, which we have not touched in this revision, that has to do specifically with alcohol consumption at the riverfront, which is to say in Riverfront Park. And it's set a $3 million. That's where the $3 million policy requirement is set. It also is very specific about the alcohol that can be served. It can only be beer and wine. The quotes levels of alcohol within the wine. It quotes the licenses and permits that are required from the state Alcohol and Beverage Control Board. It's very, very specific. Now, so that any time you go down to the waterfront, you can only be served beer and wine, and you have to be served within a tent because it has to be, again, it's very specific. You have to have a confined area so that you can monitor who, you know, whether or not people going in to purchase a glass of wine or a glass of beer have the proper credentials for age, the way you would going into any bar or restaurant in the city. And so what the producers of events always do is they find a concessionaire, a vendor, Wonder Bar, Swoon, and contract with them to actually sell the beer and wine. The producer sets up a tent, and then and Wonder Bar or Swoon comes in and sets up the alcohol, sets up the tables, has the personnel who are certified as tip servers, I understand. It's a very tightly controlled set of requirements for serving alcohol.
And presumably they're responsible for making sure they're not serving underage.
Absolutely, and that's people. that is the principal purpose of the tent and of people who are specifically trained in serving alcohol. Is that the Alcohol Beverage Control Authority wants to be very, very sure that you're not serving anyone who's underage. Now, as to the insurance is not obtained by the vendor or the concessionaire. It's obtained by the producer. It's a short-term insurance policy, and you know it's for 1 day or 2 days or 3 days, and the amount that's charged by the insurer is based on the activity and the length of time of the event. And as I say, that's been going on for 8 years, and it has gone on. You know, and we had three events so far this summer. I think they're probably the only three that will occur this year that were alcohol was served. Now, what we did within the law, within the mass gathering law, was also to reference the $3 million requirement within the mass gathering law solely so that if in the event, if a producer wants to have an event in 7th Street Park or in one of the pocket parks and wishes to request a mass gathering permit that includes selling alcohol there within a tent with all the requirements that I've already mentioned, they can now do so. They couldn't before because there was not provision for selling alcohol. I don't expect it will be used that much, but because I think that right now the focus of events is really Waterfront Park. But for example, we have plans to try to renovate 7th Street Park. And that could become a new focus of activity. We hope it would, if our plans come to fruition in the next three or four years for upgrading the 7th Street Park. I mean, remember all the parades before Waterfront Park was restored, renovated 5 or 6 years ago, all came west on up Warren Street and ended in 7th Street Park. They didn't end at the waterfront because the waterfront was all gas tanks.
It was nasty.
Yeah, so you know, so that it's, you know, we're trying to take into consideration a little looking forward to sort of the expansion of Hudson as a place to celebrate and attract tourists and generate some income.
Is this veto by the mayor indicative of kind of an adversary relationship between him and the majority of the Common Council?
Well, let me just add that I hope not. I set particular sort of parameters or standards for my job as the president of the Common Council, and I look at the job as having sort of two distinct dynamics. One of them has to do with governing and legislating, and the other has to do with small p politics. And I think that when the public elects us, we should do as much as we possibly can to pay attention to the dynamic of governing and legislating, and as little attention as possible to the dynamic of small p politics, of who's winning and who's losing, and placing winning and losing above the public interest of what they elected us to do. I'm not someone who suggests that I am a politician, and I hope with a large P. And I think that in a democratic society, we are supposed to run we are supposed to gain the public's trust and confidence through the ballot box, and hope that we can maintain it as we govern. And I think that politics is a craft. It's something that tells you that where you pay attention to constituencies, where you pay attention to coalitions, where you pay attention to what the city needs, either in whole or in part, and try to do the best you can in that. I think that we did two things last night that I think are indicative of this. Last night we finally passed by overriding the mayor's veto, the amendments to the mass gathering law. that's something that has truly has citywide implications. It doesn't relate to any particular part of the city.
Did you pass it by a hair, or did you pass it with votes to spare?
No, we passed it, I guess you can say, by a hair. I mean, with a weighted vote, we had, I don't know, maybe 40 extra votes, something like that. So that was close. However, let me finish the point. The other thing we did last night, though, is we also passed a resolution affirming that the council wants to placing a mandate on the mayor and the superintendent of public works, and also on itself, on the council, to come up with a plan for a temporary handicap access ramp for Promenade Hill. This has been a particular concern to the people in the second ward, particularly because both there are any number of elderly folks at Providence Hall who are in wheelchairs and who would like to be able to gain access to Promenade Hill. We've been talking about that for a few years. There are many families with small children and baby carriages. There's the Hudson City Daycare Center that takes its kids up to Promenade Hill. There's a really good reason to have a ramp there. And so we passed this resolution calling for there to be a ramp and for there to be a study and for it to be done within 3 months. And that's the sort of back and forth that I like to see in legislating. It happens occasionally that you end up with sort of underlying conflicts that are sort of inherent to any small city. Certainly Hudson has them, that emerge every once in a while, and I think some of that happened over this particular issue. I hope that they will subside, and I will do everything I think I can that's possible to see them subside. I think that this particular council is also one that wants to see them subside. I think that for a council to vote as it did across party lines, across ward boundaries, in favor of going forward with this law, speaks to the fact that this is a council this year that has come to understand rather quickly that it enjoys working together and enjoys, and that it can trust the process and the colleagues to come up with reasonably good answers when they are thought through. You know, we have 4 new members of the council this year. Now we have Bart Delaney, who's a Republican, Alexis Keith, Henry Haddad, and Tiffany Gariga. And all of them have applied themselves really vigorously and effectively to doing their jobs, which is representing the people who elected them and then working together with the people with whom they serve on the council. I'm really proud of us. I'm not going to crow about victories because I really don't think that, you know, winning and losing, I think that gets exaggerated, but I am very proud of what we did last night.
It has been a couple of years since I attended a common council meeting, and then I was there last night, and I did notice a kind of new dynamic. Mm-hmm. So good for you guys.
Yeah. Well, practice, practice, practice.
Now, the people who voted against the meetings, the open meeting or mass gathering mm-hmm. law, were Alderman Robert Donahue and Alderwoman Irene Stewart, and Abdus Mia mm-hmm. abstained.
Right.
Now, what were their reasons?
Well, Doc Donahue didn't state his reasons. Alderman Mia stated his reasons, but he had a terrible cold, and I was not able to really grasp his arguments because he had a couple of them. I am told by my colleagues that who sit a little closer that he was expressing some of the same concerns as the mayor, but I really would need to clarify that with him. And Alderwoman Stewart was concerned that somehow she had two concerns. One was that the that somehow this law would require anyone to who already has a mass gathering permit to resubmit for a mass gathering permit, and that if their event was within 120 days of occurring, that they somehow would be prevented from holding that event. That's as best I can represent the logic. Now, as I said, I think fairly clearly last night, that is not the case. We do not have any intention of interfering with event mass gathering applications that are already in. And indeed, the U.S. Constitution speaks on this issue, and it's about what's called ex post facto. We're prohibited from going back and changing a law that has already under which actions have already taken place, i.e., approving mass gathering permits. So I'm not sure how that one logically follows. Alderman Stewart was also concerned about the changes in the law having to do with the asking whether or not there was. I think that she was that she believed that there was not discretionary authority, as I've described earlier. Other than that, I don't frankly recall. There may have been one or two other things that she said, but I don't have them on the top of my mind right now.
I remember a couple of years ago reading the Hudson Business Communities listserv and hearing frantic business owners saying, Warren Street's been closed. I think American Glory, the restaurant, sort of in the middle of Warren Street, had an event that closed a couple blocks.
Mm-hmm.
And business owners tell me that it shuts them down. If people can't park or get to them, they can't really shop, and
right.
People lose income.
Mm-hmm.
So if an event is sprung on them, it's kind of a hardship.
Right. And that is why we included the notice requirement, so that people can be notified and know that someone's planning something like this, or at least that they've applied for a permit. And, yes, it was, none of us is perfect, and I would be the last one to say that I haven't planned something poorly and not thought it through enough, and I think that was in part what happened with American Glory. They had a major event the previous year with the car show and motorcycle drive-in, and it was a huge event, and I think that the second time that they put it together, they didn't think through completely what the implications were or how the event would be organized, and ended up with a permit for 8 hours. As I recall, I'm almost certain that's correct. I think it was 12 to 8 that the street was to be closed. And an event that turned out to have very poor attendance. Both from the point of view of the exhibitors, of the people who had vehicles, and also of the people who attended, so that if you have Warren Street on a Saturday closed off for that many hours, there are a number of businesses there that will really be seriously affected, because they have a good deal of foot traffic. And if it's if an event is regardless of whether or not the foot traffic the businesses are affected, if an event is not well thought through, then I think that it's incumbent on the city. It's the city's responsibility to keep a weather eye out for an event like that might cause some difficulty. Because of its impact.
I've heard that a certain number of politicians, including the mayor, receive free meals at American Glory. I don't know if you've heard that.
I have nothing I can comment about that. I think that You know, that for me, you know, I don't know what to say. You know, in a small city, there are rumors all over the place, and you know, I don't unless I have a pretty good firsthand. Unless I've seen something myself, I really don't think it's, you know, valuable to get into. You know, it's like the Voy Forum. I don't want to have, you know, I'm not looking to, you know, there's no purpose in my mind to, you know, to giving any credence to stories that have, you know, that can't be verified.
The mayor's up for re-election this year. Is there any possibility that his behavior the veto has anything to do with that?
No, that's part of the problem. He's not up for election this year.
Oh, he's not?
No,
okay.
He's up for election next year. We're all up for election next year.
Okay.
And it's one of the, yes, I think that, I think your statement reflects part of my difficulty with what's been going on for the last month or so, because the behavior of too many people has made this look as if it's an election year when indeed it's not. This is when we should be most concentrating on governing and legislating. And I know the mayor would disagree with me on the substance of his criticisms of the mass gathering permit, and indeed that they are issues of legislation. But it does bear an awfully close resemblance to a campaign, which shouldn't start until the middle of next year.
It does bring to mind one of the subtle points of observing official behavior in this area. Some things are politically driven, maybe way in advance of elections.
You know,
and it's hard to know when they are.
I'm going to give you a point of view about that, because I've thought a fair amount about it, and I think that one of the challenges that many communities face, and it's not just Hudson, it's not just Columbia County, I know this from other communities as well, is that there has been a good deal of social and cultural change in this country, and we can see that right here on the ground in Hudson. The movement of so many new people into Hudson over the last 25 or 30 years, that has indeed changed the character of Hudson. And that can cause conflict, because it causes uncertainty. It causes, you know, there are, you know, great influxes of people who you don't know. They may be different than many of the people who, you know, who you know, who you've known for a long while, and I think that's one of the basic challenges of knitting Hudson together and having it move forward together, and of governing Hudson, is to understand how inherent those conflicts are, to understand that they're real, not to try to hide from them, but try to find ways to reduce them when it's at all possible. And I do think that really has a great deal to do with the conflicts in Hudson. Is that simply people who are different? And on the other hand, I think that one of the strengths that many of us, forgive my sort of personalizing this, but many of us bring to Hudson is that we really do love diversity. And there is no inherent hostility to what Hudson's history has been, and to, you know, the people who've built it and made it what it is today. The people who've been here all of their lives and who have jobs here, who have had them here, who have watched jobs disappear and had to find others, who have had children here and raised them, who've struggled with the school system, as we have. These folks, you know, they were all immigrants at one time too. They, you know, many people who have been here all of their lives came from New York City, just in the way many people come from, you know, larger urban areas now. And I think that, you know, we have, as a consequence, this influx has has really brought a great deal of economic stability back to a city that where that was not, you know, where that had been a great concern. You know, we lost so many manufacturing jobs here. You know, the only stable, you know, in the main, the only stable employment in Hudson or particularly or in Columbia County has been public service employment. And
it's true. It's been a rough 4 or 5 years.
Right. Yes.
Maybe longer. Maybe
yeah. A good 10 to 20. If you count back the button factory and the pocketbook factory and the, you know, the overhead door factory and the match factory and all these places that have simply gone away. Now, you know, we're beginning to see a revival. We're beginning to see we have craft tech that's hiring in technical jobs, not you know, the most complex technical jobs, but good jobs for the future. We have Harney's Tea coming in, which is taking over the button factory and is going to put 25 to 50 jobs in bottling teas.
That's exciting.
That's really, it is. And so the people who think that, you know, who argue that manufacturing and production is gone from the United States or this area, you know, well, probably not.
We have artisanal foods, distilleries, breweries.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. And they're beginning, we are beginning to see real jobs come back here. And I think I've also said that I think that one of Hudson's greatest friends is population growth, because I think that we are benefiting from the fact that you know, that many of the major urban areas, Boston, New York, Washington, you know, are simply getting, you know, they're getting, you know, people are, it's too crowded. People are looking for other decent places to live. Again, just the way people did 50 or 75 years ago when they first came to Hudson. You know, they were looking for, you know, a more congenial environment, something's less stressful, more open, more in the, you know, where, how did this little city get to be a little city in the middle of nowhere?
Well, it started with the whaling, I think.
It did start with whaling, but it, you know, rather quickly became a small commercial center.
Yeah.
And a very, you know, a handsome, lively urban center.
We've seen an influx of artists as studio space in New York City has gotten out of reach for many.
Yep, we have. We've seen that. And I think, you know, we've also experienced an extraordinary real estate boom in town, which in some ways is good because it will, you know, will improve the property tax base. On the other hand, we also, because we have, a great deal of respect for, you know, for diversity here, we don't, you know, we have to make sure that we have affordable housing. We have to be sure that the people who are middle income and lower income, that their taxes are not disproportionately increased. And I think one of the things that, and I've mentioned this before on shows, is that one of the things that I think that we have seen accomplished over the last 3 or 4 years is we undertook a citywide property tax reassessment, and one of the most controversial issues in this town was not the level of property taxation is still a problem, but the unfair and maddeningly uneven application of assessments across the city caused an enormous problems. I mean, we had 3 years ago, we had over 550 grievances 1 year of property taxes. I think this year we're down now to something like 30.
I heard it was even hard at one time for people to get a hold of their records to have access.
Right, right, yeah, it was. And
that's progress.
It really is, and I appreciate you, and I appreciate your saying so, because I do think it is. Property taxation is a terrible way of taxing. It's probably worse than sales tax. It's worse than income tax. It's the most regressive way of taxing, but it is what we have to deal with.
Yeah, and I can't get over feeling that people who put a lot of money into their houses, improving the housing stock and the ambiance and the whole quality of life in the city, are being punished. for doing that?
Well, that is happening much less. I would have to argue because again, it's the taxation has been evened, and in other words, with property taxes, if assessments are unevenly applied, yes, you definitely get into a situation where people have a very justified right to complain that they're being treated unfairly. If you have, if you have a fair system for assessments, then people's their taxes aren't disproportionate to other people who have houses that are valued the same. And I think that's why things have quieted down here, because people don't look across the street at an identical house and say, why are your taxes, half of what mine are? Anyway, that's...
Now, I know there was a recent discovery in the past year when attorney Ken Dow looked into the land leases, would you say, on the waterfront, and discovered that land that Holcim was about to deed over to the city was already owned by the city. And is that the correct way of expressing what occurred?
Yeah.
It's 9.97 acres that Holcim was offering the city?
No. Let's see, briefly, in the discussions that took place during the development of the local waterfront development program, there were sort of semi negotiations with Holcim that indeed that they would, when the LWRP was passed, convey 7 acres of the 14 acres on the port property, which is to say the property east of the railroad tracks, and that they would also convey title to the South Bay, about 100 acres. When the LWRP was passed, Holcim went very quiet. We asked them about that. They said they wouldn't talk about it, and which is basically say they were reneging on the deal. Then about a year and a half ago, we decided that we would investigate eminent domain as a way of attempting to have Holcim transfer the property to the city, the seven acres that had been discussed during the LWRP. We put a good deal of money into surveys, into discussions with land conservation groups about taking over the South Bay and making it into an environmental study center. And Holcim was engaged with us, and they indeed, we thought in good faith, we found out afterwards not in good faith, agreed to map out 9.4 acres on the waterfront parcel, the 14 acres, and that they would convey those to the city. At the same time, the Valley Alliance and its attorney, Ken Dow, We're looking into whether or not Holcim actually had title to some of those 14 acres. What Ken Dow discovered, indeed, was that Holcim did not have title to all of the acreage, that there were 4.4, I believe, acres that the city had improperly conveyed in a land swap when the LB Furniture Building was first built. In other words, that Holcim, to make a long story short, did not have proper title to that land, and that it reverts and it indeed remains the city's property. Now the land, the 4 acres, are on the very southern tip of the port property, and probably a quarter to a third of it is or what are called lands underwater. However, it does provide some opening for us, and frankly, and this is the takeaway, is that I think that we are going to have to go back and actually begin eminent domain proceedings against Holcim, which I hope we will plan to do this fall and take seriously. to gain at least the 7 acre, the total of 7 acres, if not the full, if not the 9.4 acres that we were discussing before. Because I think that we need to, you know, if we need to have that issue resolved. And I think that the, the Valley Alliance and Ken have done is they have provided us with some leverage in this argument with on eminent domain, because indeed, if we do go forward with eminent domain, and I very much hope that I believe the council will support this, and I hope the mayor will as well, we only need to eminent domain three or four acres in order to get to our seven. That was the agreement that we had with them in principle, if not in writing, during the LWRP. Now, why is that important? It's always been important that we get the to have the port property, because that will then mean that a cement plant or a processing plant down there is no longer possible. And I also hope that if we, that indeed when we proceed with this eminent domain, that we include the South Bay. Because if we get both of those, then we will have achieved what we wanted to achieve within the LWRP. And indeed, that getting to that point will also spring loose, I hope, the Department of State's final approval of our LWRP, which they have upheld, which they have withheld, excuse me, because the lands were not transferred by Holcim to the city. So it's complicated, but indeed I think that what the Valley Alliance has done has been very helpful, and in terms of moving us forward to get the to approach Holcim in a legal fashion to do what they said they do and then backed away from.
It sounds like that's an important first piece of the puzzle.
It is. It
you
is.
Can't
it's a big help.
Go forward with development of that waterfront property until the state approves?
The state, that's correct. The state has in its wisdom, and I use that term sarcastically, I will confess or admit, has said that we cannot do the development on the waterfront that we want to do until we get the 7 acres. Now, an LWRP, one of the principal reasons to have an approved LWRP is because it makes a municipality such as Hudson eligible for substantial millions amount of dollars in funding for projects like the rehabilitation of the South Bay, or the North Bay the North Bay Recreation Area, it defies logic why they would withhold their approval for us to go forward with the substantial plans that the Department of State, wants to see along the waterfront of projects like these, environmentally and ecologically very sound projects. So, yes, it's important, and it is one of my top priorities for the next 6 months.
It seems like there's tremendous potential there, even though there may be some pollution and some, flooding possibilities. But still, I can see cafes down there, people able to rent kayaks or other boats. There's already a ferry, which we didn't have so long ago.
Right.
More parks. What's going to happen with the property where the Fergery Boat Club used to be?
Well, that will probably become part of the North Bay Recreation Area. It's a natural part. The North Bay Recreation Area is a project that was planned by the Columbia Land Conservancy, and it extends basically from the sewage treatment plant, which is adjacent to the Fuggery property, all the way up to and connects with the Greenport Conservation Area. It's a major park development and environmental study project.
So there's a chance for bicycle paths up and down the river?
Not bicycle paths. It would only be hiking trails at this point. The area is too rough. There is the issue of the landfill, which is a major part of the of that area. But to you know, finish your question about the Fuggery, what should happen there is that I think that we, and I think we fairly well all agree on what should happen, is that there should be a couple of the shacks retained as examples of, you know, what was there, and they could be either study centers or they could have some functional purpose as an administrative area or boat rental. But the Fuggery is that property is that piece of park, which it is now, is positioned perfectly for people who want to kayak or canoe in the North Bay itself, because the only other access to the North Bay is under a trestle from the river. And you certainly can, but it's very it's very affected by tidal waters. In other words, at high tide, it's not at all easy to get it from the river underneath a trestle into the bay, and it's not something one would recommend to inexperienced kayakers or canoers. However, there is a boat launch at the the Fuggery property that could easily allow access to the North Bay. And it's a beautiful, I mean, the bay is beautiful to paddle in. I've been in there.
Me too. It's lovely. Mm-hmm. Wildlife. And
yeah.
The first time I came upon those shacks, I didn't know what that was.
Right.
One problem I have with the waterfront is the ugly chain link fence that's near the Hudson Yacht Club or Powerboat Owners Club or whatever it's called.
Oh, which?
Is there any plan to ameliorate that situation? It's near the powerboat launch, which is, there's also the rickety bridge over the, that allows you to get to that parking lot where you can park. And then there's a cement ramp into the water where you can drag a kayak in.
Mm-hmm.
Or any other.
I'm sorry, I'm missing the chain link fence. I mean,
I suppose the boat club thinks it protects their owners. It's near where all the boats are docked. It impairs one's view of the waterfront. It's hideous.
Well, they unfortunately own the property. Well, not unfortunately. It's just a fact of life. They own the property so that they can. I'm trying to envision where the chain link fence is. There's a chain link fence at the north end of the state boat launch parking lot. There is possibly one at the old ferry slip.
All along those docks.
Well, as I say, I think that's a private property issue because they do own. I'm not envisioning exactly where the chain link fence is that you mean. I think another one to mention briefly that before we have to close down here, and I'm very grateful for the fact that you've given me this time to be on, has to do with the Ferry Street Bridge, because that is crumbling, and we. And the city attorney, Carl Whitbeck, has recently done some research that indicates that we do indeed own this bridge, something that had been up in the air heretofore. And so now we have some clear path to see whether or not we can to come up with a plan to replace it.
Oh, good.
The council approved $30,000 for a plan to develop engineering specifications and renderings to replace it, and then which we will do before the end of the year.
On that note, I think we're going to have to